Welcome to this episode of Fossils and Fiction, a podcast that explores the stories of prehistoric life, most often through the stories we humans tell about it. It's produced by me, Travis Holland, with support from Charles Sturt University. Enjoy. I try not to make every episode of this podcast about Jurassic Park, or even mention Jurassic Park, but I've probably failed on that count, as you can plainly see if you look at the transcripts from these episodes. And after 30 years, what more is there to say about Jurassic Park? Well, it turns out for me quite a lot, and I've been doing some thinking, reading, and writing on that over the last 12 months. In this episode, I'm going to revisit some of my thoughts from that period. I've also been fortunate enough to appear on a variety of radio and podcast interviews recently, and I will bring you some clips from those episodes as well.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
So this year, Jurassic Park turned 30. This is a film that has spawned 5 sequels, a television show, numerous video games, and hundreds of toys, comics, and more. Aside from the obvious plot of dinosaurs breaking out and terrorizing scientists and park workers, the film meditates on a bunch of really important questions. These all originate with Michael Crichton's book, which Spielberg adapted into the film we all know and love. I'm right in the age bracket that seems particularly taken by Jurassic Park. I was nearly 7 when it was released here in Australia, and I quite vividly remember going to see it. At that time, I was obsessed mostly with trains and dinosaurs, and while I still appreciate a good steam engine, Jurassic Park cemented the dinosaurs as my main love, and that has persisted through much of my life. Although I must admit, I did have a few dark years where I got distracted by a bunch of other things. Around the world, there were a billion other kids my age who also saw this movie, and a good number of them went on to study dinosaurs and other prehistoric life. Those millennial paleontologists are now some of the field's leading researchers. I've been fortunate to have interviewed many of those folk on this podcast, and I hope to speak to more of them as the project continues to evolve and grow. But back to some of those questions that Jurassic Park asks. It asks us to contend with our relationship with nature, and right alongside that, it poses questions about how we develop and use technology. One question that is plain in the script, if not the themes, is about the relationship between genders.
But again, how do you know they're all female? Or has somebody go out in the park and pull up the dinosaur's skirts?
We control their chromosomes. It's really not that difficult. All vertebrate embryos are inherently female anyway. They just require an extra hormone given at the right developmental stage to make them male. But we simply deny them that.
So with my colleague Lisa Watt, that was the subject of my first recent article on Jurassic Park in The Conversation, and a follow-up book chapter. We looked at the representation of women in Jurassic Park, with a side look at the representation of masculinity, and also what the all-female dinosaurs mean in the context of that debate. In the book chapter, which we titled Sexism in Survival Situations, Lisa and I discuss a number of illuminating scenes. For example, the notion put by John Hammond that he should be the one to help reset the park's power supply alongside Ray Arnold when Ellie Sattler volunteers herself to do so. Hammond seems to think that he, as a man, is more able to undertake the task, even though he is 50 years Sattler's senior. The chapter appeared in this book, Gender and Action Films, 1980 to 2000, edited by Stephen Gerard and Renee Middlemost. We were really pleased with some of the analysis that we included. There's also the line that has become something of a pop culture touchstone. Sitting in the cars outside the Tyrannosaurus paddock, this exchange takes place.
God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs eat man. Woman inherits the earth.
After Sattler's line, Grant and Malcolm stare at her basically dumbfounded. It's as if, with that one line, she's changed their whole worldview. But even despite these lines, the two in particular that I've pointed to, we argue in that book chapter that the women of Jurassic Park and Jurassic World films actually do have far less agency than their male counterparts. There was a bit of an asinine debate on Twitter a while ago that the death of Claire's assistant Zara in Jurassic World was cruel and sexist. But isn't it more sexist that she was the first woman killed on screen? Until then, they'd actually been pretty absent from the main action scenes. They always felt like they had pretty strong plot armor built in. In that article in The Conversation, we talked about the way in which Claire Deering progressed from her tailored white suit to a more disheveled appearance, in which she ran from the T-Rex in heels at the end of the film. That particular sequence was widely criticised ahead of and after Jurassic World's release. And then there's Sarah Harding. I think the biggest problem with Harding, played by Julianne Moore in The Lost World, isn't her lack of action or skill. She has that in spades. What annoys me about the character is that she isn't half as badass as the Sarah Harding in the book written by Michael Crichton. That Sarah Harding single-handedly carries a comatose Ian Malcolm up the underside of the trailer. She wasn't the one foolish enough to bring the baby T-Rex back to the trailer in the first place. She chases down a velociraptor on a motorbike, while also teaching Kelly Malcolm how to shoot. And she kills Lewis Dodgson. That's a character I'd love to see on film. In the book chapter, we go into a lot more detail, describing the female characters as either scientists or screamers, and the male characters as largely hunters or sex symbols. Though everyone really falls along a continuum, rather than usually at either end. And we draw upon the work of earlier scholars who argue that the monstrous feminine was at work in the all-female dinosaurs of Jurassic Park. More recently, I wrote another article for The Conversation that looked at the influence on Jurassic Park on both filmmaking and paleontology for the film's 30th anniversary. On the special effects side of the ledger, I noted that according to industry legend and multiple documentaries, Spielberg had planned to only use practical effects, including stop-motion velociraptors and the animatronic Tyrannosaurus. However, well into the filming schedule, he was convinced to also include wholly digital dinosaurs after ILM staff had produced test footage and shown it to him. In A Critical History of ILM, Julie Turnick observes that the film relied on a canny mix of large-scale mechanical effects cut together with a few digitally generated shots. After its success, ILM embraced digital composition technology more fully and integrated it into many later films. Whether because the technology was new or because of Spielberg's adherence to craft, Jurassic Park isn't overly saturated with CGI. It features about 50 shots of digital-only prehistoric creatures, including that first full-bodied shot of a dinosaur, the sauropod Brachiosaurus, as well as flocking Gallimimus and the T-Rex chasing the Jeep. Nowadays, films and television productions are replete with photoreal computer-generated animals and people, and the next revolution in screen production has them projected live behind actors on a series of screens known as the volume. So CGI now occurs before the filming takes place. In addition to the dinosaurs, Jurassic Park also featured the first CGI face replacement, the stunt performer filling in for Lex as she fell through the roof toward a velociraptor, looked up at the camera, and Spielberg decided to keep the shot, but replace the actor's face with that of Ariana Richards.
You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now they're selling it. You're going to sell it. Well,
Paleontology and associated sciences have seen an extensive rebound in public interest in the 30 years since Jurassic Park was released. In 1975, paleontologist Robert Bakker popularized the term dinosaur renaissance to describe a spate of developing research findings which argued the creatures were endothermic, or warm-blooded, active, and related to birds rather than cold-blooded, slow, and wholly extinct, as had been the public perception for much of the previous century. This dinosaur renaissance lasted from the 1960s into the 80s, and Jurassic Park reflected many of these new orthodoxies. But the film also arrived at the dawn of yet another new age of dinosaur discoveries, which Steve Brissetti, in the book I've got here on screen, called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs. Brissetti referred to the cohort of scientists making these newer discoveries as men and women from many backgrounds who came of age in the Jurassic Park era. That's the millennial paleontologists I referred to earlier. And in a recent review of the last 60 years of dinosaur research by celebrated paleontologist Philip J. Curry, he suggested that public interest continues to be stimulated by a multi-billion dollar movie, media, and toy industry founded on our interest in dinosaurs. Although dinosaurs have long featured in pop culture, such as films and television, it was Jurassic Park which truly presented them as believable living creatures for the first time. As a follow-up from my publication of these articles, I was contacted by ABC Nightlife here in Australia to do an interview alongside Nick Campioni, whom I featured on this podcast recently as well. Here's a short extract from that interview. The interviewer is Suzanne Hill.
Now, I want to take a listen to one of your favourite scenes and sounds, Nick. It's that terrifying moment the T-Rex emerges out of a paddock in the rain.
Absolutely still. This vision is based on movement.
Tell us about what we're hearing there, Nick.
So that's the moment where the wires come off the paddock, and the T-Rex first steps out in between the two vehicles. I think that was the scene that most impressed me as an 11-year-old. And the sound the Tyrannosaurus makes is one of my favorite sounds in cinema.
Now, Travis, how did they actually make that sound?
Yeah, so the sounds of the Tyrannosaurus were made from a bunch of different animals, including elephants bellowing, and I believe they also used seals. And at one stage, they recorded one of the sound engineer's dogs and used some of the growling for that as well. For things like the Velociraptors and the Dilophosaurus, they were using bird sounds and bird chirps, and we hear that quite a lot. Now, these were, you know, the pitch was changed and various other things, so they weren't immediately recognisable, but essentially that's what they were using as the bass sound for most of these dinosaurs. The T-Rex was a bunch of layered different sounds, but mostly from large mammals.
And Nick, do we actually know anything at all about what the dinosaurs would have sounded like?
It's hard to tell. I guess the short answer is not really. There's some evidence that this suggests that these early birds did have an organ called the syrinx, which actually allows modern birds to have the kind of vocalization that we see. And that does go back into the Cretaceous, but that's still very much already animals that are birds. There's no evidence so far that that organ existed in dinosaurs. So it's hard to tell at this stage. There's been some ideas with other groups of dinosaurs, things like the crested dinosaurs, that they might have used them to kind of as resonating chambers to create sort of loud bellowing sounds. But it's all pretty speculative, really.
Is there any chance that maybe they chirped like birds?
I suppose it's possible.
I'm just wondering if the sky's the limit when it comes to what they might have sounded like, or there really is a defined criteria of what sounds were possible.
Even modern birds obviously have a very eclectic range of sounds that they can make. And so I think it's safe to say that given the diversity of dinosaurs that we know, they were probably also making a diverse range of sounds. Whether that is exactly like birds, it's hard to tell at this stage.
All right, that's my fantasy, that secretly they actually sounded like birds and had lovely lovely singing voices. Now, Nick, because we've asked you both for a favourite scene, and Nick, this is one you've nominated, one that people might remember. It's got the huge Triceratops moaning in pain, lying on its side.
Don't be scared. Come on, it's okay. We'll do a tranquilizer for me. She's sick.
Travis, do you remember that one too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Alan Grant, the on-screen paleontologist, says something like, "She was always my favourite as a kid, and now that I see her, she's the most beautiful thing I ever saw." And I have to say that's pretty accurate.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. Now, Travis, you're studying paleontology now yourself through the University of New England. How did that all come about?
Well, actually, through Nick. I was wanting... Look, he didn't have to do the hard sell, I will say that, but Nick developed a new unit a little while ago called Dinosaurs, which got a little bit of press, and I saw this on Twitter, and I just said to him, "Well, this looks really cool. Can I study it?" And I went and signed up to study the undergraduate certificate in paleontology at UNE.
I love it. So you're a senior lecturer in communications, then you're studying a bit of paleontology on the side. Is it just for interest, or is there something you might be able to do with that professionally?
No, I am doing research at the moment into how science is represented in the media, and that's where a lot of my research has been in the last couple of years. And so I did a little bit of study in space science a few years ago, and now paleontology, and those are the two fields I've kind of been writing about. Both space and dinosaurs, basically. So, producing a podcast and doing research into how these sorts of stories become popular and popular in the media, and how we talk about science and things like this in the media and in film and television, which is obviously where the Conversation article originated.
Following that, the Conversation Weekly asked for an interview as well. Nihal El-Hadi's questions were poignant and very interesting. Although I repeated a few things from the earlier work, I also had a chance to think about things in fresh ways. The links between Jurassic Park and other paleo media were part of that conversation. On a cultural level, this is a film that changed the way that dinosaurs have been seen globally for a long time. And it came at this kind of pivot point between the dinosaur renaissance and then the later golden age, as it's been termed by paleontologist Stephen Brissati and others. The golden age of dinosaur discovery, I think, can be traced back to a lot of these kind of millennial scientists who watched the film as kids, who were inspired to see dinosaurs living and breathing in front of them, perhaps for the first time. And there was a lot of research happening throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, which was called the dinosaur renaissance. We'd had dinosaurs through the 1850s and on, and they had sparked a lot of interest, but it kind of died off in the early part of the 1900s. And then we started to see through the mid part of the 1900s this dinosaur renaissance, where there was a spate of interest, research, discoveries happening all around the world. Jurassic Park came at the tail end of that, and so it took all of this new science and made it public. And what has kind of got me interested in more recent years is the way that it took that science that had been existing and put it into the public consciousness. So suddenly people saw dinosaurs in a way they hadn't seen them before.
Travis says that the film quite deliberately places itself within a larger tradition of paleo art.
It built on a lot of pre-existing paleo media and paleo art. There's scenes in there which are reminiscent of earlier films and murals as well.
Can you give me any examples?
Yeah, sure. So there's a famous scene just after they see the Brachiosaurus for the first time, and they're kind of staring up at this animal in front of them. It's high above the treetops, eating leaves. And after they see this dinosaur in front of them, they look out to see herds of dinosaurs. And there are two other Brachiosaurus in the herds down in the valley. They're coming up out of the water. That's a really direct reference to some of the murals which showed sauropods being in the water, because it was assumed that they couldn't be supporting their own weight up on land, and so they had to be in the water to do that. And so showing them walking up out of the water was a really symbolic way to say, this is the new science of the dinosaur renaissance that we know. And finally, I was interviewed on Canadian Talk Radio with host Shay Genham.
Is it just me that mentions the sound right up with the images? I mean, we all remember the cup of water on the dash of the vehicle, and you know, the percussion of the footstep, but also just this the I don't know what you want to call it, the scream, the call of the T-Rex. I mean, the sound to me was just as influential as the images were.
It absolutely was, and basically a lot of movies, I know it's a bane of paleontologists and whatnot, but lots of movies now and TV shows and other media follow that template. They take the T-Rex roar and literally just paste it in there. And
yeah,
paleontologists will tell you, oh, no, you know, a predatory animal won't roar because otherwise its prey has a time to run away. But Jurassic Park established that template, and it really went forward. And just on the cup of water, the particular sounds that they used there was a guitar string attached to the underside of the car dash, and they sort of plucked the string to make the ripples in the water.
Really? Fascinating. Mm. Okay. The other thing that I think it really, I mean, dinosaurs were always cool, and I think kids were always interested in dinosaurs, but it seems to me there was an absolute explosion in interest in dinosaurs, paleontology, all of it. It totally reached a new level. I mean, the influence it had on that area of science is massive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that there's this generation of millennial paleontologists, and people sometimes still talk as millennial as short term for youth, but really we're approaching our 40s now, or some of us are there. And there's this explosion of millennial paleontologists that really grew up with Jurassic Park and those kinds of films, and saw the way that they were becoming, or that dinosaurs through those films were becoming such a central part of culture in general, and took that to their advantage in moving into their sciences. And so what we really see through paleontology now is this move towards ecology, the focus on how dinosaurs really lived their life rather than just what they looked like. And that, in part, I think, was popularized also by Jurassic Park. Now, it was in turn building on a couple of decades of science,
right,
which was called the Dinosaur Renaissance at the time. And it took all of that science and said, okay, now we're going to put that into the public sphere. And that's what the advantage of a blockbuster film has over any scientific publication you want to name.
And with that, the tour through my recent work on Jurassic Park concludes. Thanks so much to all the media, the readers and listeners across the various podcasts and radio stations and articles who've engaged with my work. I hope to keep sharing more paleo stories, not just about Jurassic Park, though, into the future. I'll have all the links to those articles in the show notes. Take care. Thank you for listening to this episode of Fossils and Fiction. We're always looking for more paleo stories to tell and welcome your suggestions through our social channels. You can also send voice notes via Spotify or social media. Podcast theme music is Sonora by Quincas Morea via the YouTube Audio Library. Show notes are available on the website, fossilsfiction.co. Please subscribe and rate the podcast on your preferred podcasting platform.